birds, people, and the dogs that bring them together. This is episode number 10. My name is Bill, and you're tied to the Woe Post. It's only been a couple of days since we last spoke, because this is part two of our episode on Gordon setters. Over the last few days, Skeet and Moose have been working in the ground portion of Force Fetch, with sessions of fetching from heel and building the ladder occupying most of our training time. We've also been tuning some obedience, since both of these dogs will likely test in either senior hunter or utility at some point this year. We left off talking about the importance of stamina with hunting dogs. We're going to pick back up talking a little bit about Debbie's and Steven's kennels, some of the standout dogs that they've had over their time, their plans for 2024, and then we'll get into a little bit about woodcock banding and Pine Ridge Grouse Camp. How many dogs do you have now?
Right now, I have two.
Steven, how many dogs do you have?
I've got 9 Gordons, the Border Collie, and the Great Pyrenees.
And you just sold 2 dogs.
Yeah, I did. I just moved 2 dogs out. Yeah, so I had 11 at the end of the hunting season. I had 11. Yep. Yeah, yeah. So that's what I, that's part of it. And hopefully more on the way. Fingers crossed.
There's always room for one more, right?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Always room. But you know what? You know, you got to. It's what I do. So I'm just like any other business. I have to have a succession plan in place. You know, I have to have young dogs coming up to take over for old dogs that are fading away. You know, my prime age dogs, the 2 to 7 year old dogs, they got 5 years of solid prime. Some will go further. Some starting to fade a little bit, 7, 8 years old. But you know, you got to be running. And then you got the 1.5 up to 2 year olds, but you can't run them all day. You know, you got to watch those joints are not fused tight and all that stuff. And you're getting them out there. You're not scouting over them. You don't want to waste their minutes on the ground and cover you're not sure about. You're putting them in the best cover you have because you want to make sure they're getting plenty of bird contact. But with that, you're watching your wristwatch because you know, okay, 1.5 hours up, I got to put that dog up. He's done. You know, that's, I don't care if we're right in the middle of everything. I'll pick them up and put them in the truck because I want them to last. I want them to last up to 10, 11 years old. And that's, you know, I think a lot of people that they've got this young dog, it's their first dog, is a year old. They're going to run him all day. And that's fine. Yeah, he got out of bed the next day. He felt great. Well, that's fine. But when he's 6 and 7 and those joints are disintegrated, you're going to wish you'd have put him up after 1.5 hours.
I think a lot more people are becoming aware of that. I've seen more articles about that.
And, yeah.
About 1.5 years is when I start to, you know, I do agility and stuff in the off season. And, you know, I didn't start training Valia and agility until she was 1.5 years old, because I don't want, I mean, she'll run through the woods and stuff, but I'm not going to purposely be pounding her joints over jumps and all of that stuff when her bones are not fully ossified. So.
Exactly. And like I said, it doesn't show up right away. It's going to be something you're going to see down the road, and then you're going to wonder what happened. Well, you're not going to think about it. Oh, it's because the first year of her life, I ran her to death every day during the hunting season. But that's when it shows up.
So. Yep.
So what are some of the standout dogs that you've had come out of your kennel?
When was it, Stephen? Was it 2019? When you 18, had the...
2018.
Stephen showed up at Pine Ridge. Because he, I don't know, you had heard that we were doing banding. So he drove all the way up from North Carolina and Jerry, you know, sent us out together. He's like, he has Gordons too. So go out there. And it wasn't very long. And, you know, we're talking about our philosophy about these things, and we aligned pretty closely. And I loved the way that his dogs worked. And I was in the market for another dog. And I think, wasn't it by the end of the day that I was on your list for that litter that you were going to be breeding the next week?
Yeah. Because and that it was like, is yeah. My, cause I think we ran Blue and Sasha, and I'm like,
she was in heat.
I'm getting ready to breed those two. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Yeah. So I got right on board, and that's when I got Bogey, and Bogey is 5. He'll be 6 this summer. And he's phenomenal. He's not, mm-hmm. I wouldn't consider him to be in standard, however. You know, no. He's very stylish, very flashy, very intense. very fast. He's more of, you know, what you would consider maybe an English setter would run like, but I like that, you know, and I like his ability. And so that's why I'm breeding him. I want to pass that on and not lose some of that stuff. Not that I think that he's, you know, the best dog in the world, but I want to keep a lot of his traits that he has. And then I imported Valia. She'll be 2 in July. And I imported her from Slovakia. And that's where Steven got his 2 dogs. He imported 2 dogs from there. And they turned out really excellent. And so I just went back to the same breeder and got myself a female. So that's where I'm at. I've had dogs, you know, in the interim, but I think Bogey's the best hunting dog I've ever had, and quite possibly maybe the best I'll ever have.
Well, let's hope not. You got a long way to go.
That'd be nice.
Jake's dog Gordy comes out of Bogey, right?
Yeah. Bogey sired that. Yeah. And I think that so far that litter is turning out to be pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. So right now we're kind of looking at doing a repeat breeding, which, you know, we don't normally do, but if you've got something that is working really nicely, I think we're going to try to do it again. And I think I'm going to get one out of this next litter. Cause every time I see one of those puppies, I just kind of want to stick them in my jacket and take them home. Gordy.
Yep.
You know, the breeders that I was working with, they've got one, a female named Lady, and I was pet sitting her, and they're just lucky that they got her back.
I got to meet Gordy a few weeks ago, and I'll probably have an opportunity to hunt over him this fall because I will have one female that'll probably be full of puppies. So I don't think she's going to be hunting too long. And I'll have a puppy that's 5 months old at the time. So she's probably not going to be hunting a ton either. So I think I'm going to get some Gordy time.
Well, I'm going to be jealous then. Although I am going back to the UP in October, and I'm going to hook up with Jake and we're going to go hunting. So I'm really excited to see what Gordy, you know, he was talking about, I think he was planting some chuckers or something, and Gordy's out there and he points the bird and the bird flushes. The dog does not chase. He's steady. And he's kind of scratching his head going, if he's not going to chase, what am I going to do with this dog? How am I going to work with that? I've never had a dog that didn't chase. And I said, well, is it a lack of drive? He's like, no, absolutely not.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, don't kick him. Don't make him chase.
Right. Steven, what are some of your dogs that have stood out over time?
Well, my very first one was, like I said, she was a magician, but she had her health problems. And, you know, that's one of those things. I never bred her because she had what's called perianal fistulas, which is bad. So I didn't breed her. I had another bitch thrown in there. That was a mediocre dog, nothing I wanted to pass along. Gosh, I don't know. Pete was such a gentleman hunting dog. You know, we'd hunt all day and you don't have to talk to him. He just knew what to do. Blue, who, like I said, you know, the old dog here, he's still alive. He knows what to do. He knows how to do it. He doesn't care if you're there or not. If he could drive, he would just leave me at home and go hunt by himself because he loves the chase. He loves the game. He loves to find the birds and he loves to win. I can rely on Blue to find birds no matter what. Dell was, he died a year and a half ago, actually died in the cab with me on the way home from Minnesota. But he was one of the best grouse dogs I ever had because he respected grouse. Woodcock, he knew he could cheat on and get right up on them. And I banded one brood over him, but he made me nervous, so I quit with him there. But on grouse, he point grouse from a mile away because he knew he had to. He was top-notch grouse dog. Hazel, the import dog, is amazing. Her caution is amazing. She's like a cat trying to find a mouse. Sasha, Bogey's mom, Sasha, is delightful. Dogs, I can run Sasha and Hazel, and I could actually run Sasha, Hazel, and Cronin as a three, a threesome in the woods and not say a word to them. They know what to do. It's hard to say which one's your best dog. I really honestly, if somebody said, you get your best dog out of the truck, we got to find birds, I'd have to, I don't know which one it would be. I'd have to think about it and just hope for the best.
It depends on the situation.
It does. It depends on if it's raining, you know, Dell, I could always count on Dell in a hard rain because he didn't care. I guess he loved to hunt no matter what. Some dogs will look at the rain and go, ugh. Hazel doesn't mind the rain. Sasha, she's not her favorite thing. It really does. It depends on the weather. If it's hot, you know, Arlo is a fantastic dog. If it's hot though, and by hot, I mean 55 and up, you know, his nose will cut off. He gets overheated fast and his nose turns off. So I just, you know, but it's never cold enough. It could be, you know, Antarctica in the middle of winter and he'd be like happy to go hunting. Let's go. So it like she said, it does. It depends on the situation, all my dogs get so much time in the woods that they, and I didn't even mention Neri. Neri is just fabulous. I don't know. over the years, who would I hang? I would like Jerry, Jerry's dog, Al, Big Al, the big sexy. He made Jerry yep. because Jerry ran him hard his beginning years of grouse camp, of Pine Ridge grouse camp. Jerry ran him hard because that was his go-to lean on dog. And Big Al lived to be 14, but you know, he was worn out. It's kind of like Jerry is now, but that's Blue. In my early years of guiding full time, if I had to find birds, I had to put Blue on the ground and he would go all day and he would find birds for me. He knew the game, he knew what to do and I could rely on him. And that's magical. That's having that one employee that no matter what's happening, you own a restaurant, you're in the weeds, and you know that one employee is going to step up and just knock them out and have a smile on her face the whole time. You'll never know it. That was Blue. So when he dies in a few years or whatever it's going to be, I'm going to be heartbroken and distraught. But I'll replace
him. That's an end of an era.
That's an end of a dog, and it really will be. But he bailed me out more times than one. I'll leave it there.
Yep.
You know what I love about that, you know, I asked you for a standout and you just named, I didn't count. I'll try to count when we're editing later, but you named a lot of different dogs, so I, you know, it's pretty obvious you don't just have a kennel, you have a whole bunch of hunting partners.
I do, no doubt I do, and they all love to go. And I take them all. Even when old Pete got blind, I took him. He knew I was going hunting. How, I have no idea, but he would go. I would put him in the truck and go. And I guided him in Louisiana for woodcock one year when he was still alive. And he lived to be 14 and change, but he didn't hunt. But I had him in the woods and we stopped for lunch one day, you know, so I let him out of the truck and let him just get out and stumble around and go pee and stuff. And you know, and like I said, he didn't move much. And I was like, where is that dog? Well, I look over there and he's pointing a woodcock on, you know, I mean, on the side of the road back in the, and, you know, I walk over and like, look at that old dog. And the guy, you know, nobody shot or anything. We just watched, I flushed the bird for him and he knew it had flushed. And he kind of looked at me with a little bit of that old dog grin. I picked him up and put him back in the truck and he was frail and skinny and gray and the whole thing, but that nose still worked and he knew what to do. But yeah, I have a bunch of hunting partners because I take them hunting a lot, and that's like a beautiful gun. A beautiful gun is still made to be hunted with and shot. You know, I don't buy guns to put them in a closet and never look at them. I buy guns to beat them up, take them hunting. Same thing with the dogs.
So, what are your plans this year for the 9 hunting partners that you've got out in the kennel right now?
So I've got my imported dog Hazel is a very funny heat cycle. I've tried to breed her before, but have obviously been breeding her about a week too early. So I just picked her up Wednesday from the vet. We did an surgical artificial insemination with some frozen semen I own now from a dog I did not own, but with the dog is a Stetson. He's a dual champion, amateur field champion. He's long passed away now, That would be Bogey's granddad, actually. But his semen had been shipped around the world and is very heavy in Scandinavia. When the Scandinavian Gordon Setter clubs got together and were looking at their dogs, thinking we have to revitalize this breed, they started looking for the perfect Gordon, and Stetson fit the bill. His name is Stetson. He was owned by Jan and Bill Holloway. Jan has passed away now. She's a magical lady. What a fantastic lady she was. And so they left me the semen. They said, you know, we're going to give this all to you. It's getting some age on it now. And I talked to the vet yesterday, so I'm hoping for the best. Fingers crossed that it's still, you know, we have some good swimmers in there. Hopefully have a litter out of that. And for the rest of them, I've got one out there. I'll finish up. He's a little old, but I bought him back. I sold him as a puppy, and the guy just wasn't fitting the bill. So I said, no problem. I'll buy him back. I always tell anybody, if you know, if something's up, you don't like a puppy, I'll buy it back. No questions asked. I always turn them around and turn them into good bird dogs. I don't want my dogs out there floating around. You know, if somebody doesn't like one for this, that, or whatever reason, I don't question it. I buy him back. I bought Neary back that way. It was not working out for the lady. She said, you know, I get it. Some dogs just don't hunt. Neary's probably the best dog out there right now. He's amazing, and he'll hunt for anybody. I loan Neary out to about anybody, and he hunted for, gosh, I don't know, what, you and Gertch and Cameron. I think Casey took him out.
Yeah. Yep.
So he'll hunt. He doesn't care. Yep. Just put me in the car, take me hunting, I'll go. But he's a fantastic dog. So they turn.
He's beautiful to
and
watch.
He is absolutely gorgeous too. He's not. He's easy on the eyes too. So, mm-hmm. So just, you know, for my plans are the same thing. They got a little bit of a break. I'll start working them a little bit again here soon and getting them ready for banding camp. Most of them are permitted banders. All the old dogs are. The young dogs are not. They just haven't been proven yet. But I've got, you know, quite a few out there I can band over. Hopefully Hazel is pregnant, so she'll be off the list this year. I won't run her if she is. But then we'll start all over. If she has a litter, it should whelp June 5th. So October 5th, they'll be 4 months old. They'll hit the woods and learn what their profession is going to be.
Perfect.
Perfect. 4 or 5 months old on October 1st is perfect. Love it.
Mm-hmm.
Debbie, what do you have planned for the year?
Well, we've got banding coming up. I'm really, really anxiously awaiting the arrival of the woodcock. I think they might be here this week. I'm gonna go out this weekend and I'm gonna run dogs. And you know, the quiet time starts on April 16th, so I've got 2 weekends. I was injured last year, so Valia did not get as much time in the woods as she really needed to. So I'm really hoping to get her soon as they get back, every day after work, all, you know, during the weekend, we're going to be running her. Bogey probably just needs a little bit of a tune up. You know, he's a pro. And then I don't know, you know, we've got some litters planned. So there could be as many as 3 next winter, one wow. mine, and then two other that may be studded by Bogey.
Okay.
So just one mine. And that would be my first litter. So I'm excited about that. I've been learning from people, learning from Steven, learning from Dean and Donna, Denai. They own Hilltop Kennels and they've been really great mentors of mine too. And yeah, so I think I'm ready to take the plunge.
Do you have a kennel name?
My kennel name, I chose Darkwood. Gordon Setters. And I chose that because Bogey's registered name is Stony Brook's Dark Victory. Dark Victory was a movie that Humphrey Bogart was in. And I wanted to name a Bogey, you know, after that, the first Gordon I ever met. And I was, you know, looking at Humphrey Bogart movies and I saw Dark Victory for a black dog name. I thought, oh my God, that is perfect. So Dark there. And then... And then Valia comes from Slovakia, and the kennel there is Dark House of Gordons. And so there's Dark and Dark. And I originally got Valia, you know, to pair with Bogey potentially. But of course, they both carry PRA, so I can't do that. So that's where the Dark came from. And yeah, so Darkwood Gordon Setters.
All right. So we have Darkwood A litter to look forward to.
Yeah. And, I think it's going to be pretty exciting. It's been a long time coming.
And Debbie is she is a biologist, and she is very meticulous about the DNA and the testing and all that. She will be very, very good at this. She will have some very fantastic puppies because she's very smart about it. Me, I just get lucky. So.
So you guys will both be up at Pine Ridge here in about a month, Bannon Woodcock.
Correct. Yep.
Yeah, we're having our first Wisconsin banding clinic this year. So our banding program, it's run by Woodcock, Minnesota, and our banding program has now expanded into Wisconsin. And it's a little up in the air right now because Wisconsin has very different rules for running dogs in the spring and summertime, you know, different than Michigan and Minnesota. So we're still kind of trying to navigate that. But I believe it's the weekend of May 10th, we're having our first clinic in Wisconsin near Solon Springs. And then the following weekend, what would that be, like the 16th, the weekend of the 16th, 17th,
or whatever, 16th we'll through 18th have our, or something like that.
Our regular one. Yeah, we'll have our regular one at Pine Ridge. So yeah, we're going to have two workshops this year.
Yeah.
So it'll be really fun. It's super fun teaching them all of this stuff. You know, there's a ton of information, and my job, I don't know if we mentioned this, but I'm a teacher. I teach high school science. And so my job coming into the organization after I just kind of lurked for a while was to take the materials and start developing really good materials, very thorough materials, so that people can take a handbook and they can print it out and they can use it. They can read it. We do certification testing every year. Everybody has to test out. So that's my job, is to develop all the educational materials. And then I've been banding birds since 1996. So I started off, the very first bird I ever banded was a woodcock. And we used to set up mist nets and catch them when they were doing their crepuscular flights in the evening. And from there, I moved on. I worked at Hawk Ridge Bird Observatory in Duluth for 11 years. And I was in education, but I still helped out with a lot of the research stuff and, you know, banding passerines, songbirds. And I never banded any of the raptors, but and then getting into, you know, doing I'm on three different permits as a sub. So I can band songbirds and I can band woodcock, and I was putting radio transmitters on chicks, woodcock chicks, and also satellite transmitters on woodcock adults. We were trying to capture the hens, but it's really hard to do that. Shut up, Steven. Now you can tell about how good you are at catching hens.
No, go ahead.
No, you have to tell how good you are.
No, it's no.
Tell the story.
No, it's difficult. It's very difficult. I did grab one. I hand grabbed one. You know, and on the permit, I'm not nearly that permitted. I'm not nearly that. I read an article in Dad's Pointing Dog Journal in 1994 about Andy Amon and banding woodcock with pointing dogs. And I just, one of those things in the back of my head, I said, I'm going to do that one day. So as I, you know, later, you know, fast forward to the 2018, whatever it was, and I had been guiding on the UP a little bit, doing our own pop-up thing, and I was talking to Jerry about, you know, this banding workshop, and talking about guiding for him and all that stuff, and he said, come up for the banding workshop, and we'll just chat. I was like, oh, man. So, you know, I drive 1,300 miles for a four-day weekend, turn around, drive back, but but it was fantastic, and we, I think I banded three broods that weekend, if I remember right, Deb.
Wow.
You know, I think that we banded more broods that weekend than any other group did.
Oh, we did. Yeah, we did. But it was just something, and, you know, something magical about it. And Donna Dunstan, and we lost her a couple years ago to cancer, but Donna laughed. She said, you better be careful. You never want to shoot another one. And Donna could band. It didn't matter where she was. She could always just find a brood of woodcock. A Walmart parking lot.
She banded a brood honestly, in a Walmart parking lot.
In a Walmart parking lot. She finds a brood. But she was amazing. But she told me, she said, you know, you're never going to want to shoot another one. And I said, well, that's okay. You know, I've shot plenty. Banding is fantastic. It's a very meticulous type of hunting. A very cautious type of hunting. And it's not for, you know, it's not for the young dogs that are not steady. It's not out there. We don't do it so we can run dogs in the spring. We, you know, it's the old proven dogs. They have to pass the test. And even with that, I'm still a nervous wreck. You just don't want anything to happen.
Valia is, I don't know if she's even going to be ready or if I'll want to put her out there next year as a 2 year old, because they have to be mature. They have to be able to handle. I've had a hen come and hover right over the head of my dog.
Mm-hmm.
That's how steady they have to
be.
We've had hens walk right up to the dog.
Yeah.
We've had chicks, you know, because they're pointing the hen. The chicks are largely scentless. They'll point the hen. And sometimes there's chicks that are under the dog or around the dog.
Yeah.
And the chicks will, you know, depending on how old they are, they'll run and they'll make noise and everything. So these dogs have to be absolutely bomb proof. And I don't take chances with that. As you know, as a biologist, as an ornithologist, bird safety is absolutely my number one priority.
That is our number one goal with bird safety. We do want to learn as much as we can, but with that, bird safety is the first and foremost of what we're after. And like she said, and we've had, you know, birds pester the dogs, pester us, and you're trying to concentrate to make sure you're putting the bands on right and stuff. And it's a fantastic experience. It's way better than hunting. But it is, you know, very nervous. If something happens and, you know, if something happens to that hen, those chicks are going to die. So you just have to know in the back of your mind that safety is the bird safety is most important. And with that, you know, you got a dog. And like you said, if that dog is pointing the hen and it's a nice warm day, those chicks will be spread out and those chicks could be under the dog. That dog can't move because if he steps, I mean, even, you know, it takes a half step, it could, you know, step right on a chick and you'll lose it. They don't have, you know, it's nothing but fluff.
Yep.
Fluff in a beak. So just, it's a very nerve wracking time. And that's, you know, that's one reason, like I said earlier about Dell, the way he would cheat on woodcock, knowing he could get closer, it just made me too nervous.
I know we're kind of off on a tangent here, but the purpose of doing this woodcock banding is so that you could do research on woodcock. You can't do it any other way. It's very different, especially if you want to do research on, you know, chicks, because that's the only way you're ever going to find them is by using pointing dogs. They don't run off and, you know, flush into trees like grouse do. They stay super still and rely on their camouflage. And sometimes it'll take me 5 to 10 minutes to find all of the
camouflage, which is amazing.
It's so hard to find them, but you know, we've been contributing data to, you know, multiple projects. So it's basically developing a core of people that can do research or collect data or whatever. What was the one we were collecting?
Oh, the feces
files.
Yeah.
We were collecting. Yeah. We were collecting that. And they're doing DNA analysis on that to find out what they are eating.
Yeah, what the hens are eating versus what the chicks are eating to see if they're eating the same diet.
And the only way you can do that is if you've got people that have dogs and have the experience to do it. And it takes years to develop a dog to be able to do it. So it's not like, somebody can say, well, I'm going to get a dog and I'm going to do this. It takes years.
And not all, even our dogs, not all of them will pass that. And you have to be honest with yourself and say, no, you know, I can't do it over this dog or that dog. You have to be honest and look long-term and look for bird safety. So,
but it's super fun.
It's a blast.
Because I've worked so much with Bogey, he's my research partner. He's, you know, my guiding dog, and he knows exactly what he's supposed to do. And last year, Steven, do you remember that nest that we kind of thought was around there, and you ran and got Sasha and she found the nest?
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that nest hatched, and mm-hmm. we went in there, and Bogey found the hen, and we found three of the chicks, and we're looking and looking. I was mentoring an apprentice, and we were looking and looking and looking, and Bogey just turned his head, and his face was about 8 inches from a chick, because he smelled it and he knew that's what we were trying to find.
Yeah.
And he's like, it's right here. It's right here. And so I picked up that chick, and yeah, it was amazing. That partnership is so cool.
And honestly, the older dogs like that, they know what we're doing. They know, they even know they need to be more delicate in the spring. They know what's happening. They yeah. understand the consequences.
And I think they read our body language.
Oh,
we
no
are
doubt.
Very cautious.
No doubt.
You know, in the fall, you walk in because you want to flush a bird, right? Well, that's not how springtime banding works. You're very, very cautious.
Yeah.
And I like working with Bogey. I had one other banding dog that I lost. But Bogey is he'll trail. And I can ask him to go slowly, and we will creep along together, and I just kind of follow him, and it kind of gives me chills sometimes how that partnership works.
That's awesome. And it goes back to, you know, when you guys were talking about the temperament and the aptitude of the Gordons, and how it really sounds like they're the right dog for this task, as cooperative and as smart as they are.
We band a lot of birds.
Yeah, we do.
The Gordons. We one year we called ourselves the Black Storm.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, the Black Storm.
Yeah.
Caught, you know, banded 6 broods or whatever.
Yeah.
We hear a lot about woodcock banding, and you know, I think like, yeah, it's something that I'd like to do with my dog someday, but. Just talking with you guys about it just now, I'm like, yeah, there's just no way my dogs are anywhere close to ready for that. And we have different goals. We're working towards a completely different task. Steadiness is way down the list right now because of my goals for my female small monster lander, what I need to do with her between now and whenever I get it done. I have a lot of respect for a dog that can let little woodcock chicks kind of run around underneath it or between its feet or whatever, because neither one of my dogs is going to let that happen right now, I promise.
Well, and some dogs they want to kill stuff, and Gordons aren't like that.
Right.
They don't want to kill stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
That's very beneficial. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and down here in the wintertime with the woodcock flight, and you get up there too sometimes, but not quite as drastic as it's down here. You know, a tired woodcock here, a lot of times we'll get up and walk away from a doggone point. I've got plenty of videos of that, or we call them short hoppers. They fly, they fly 10 feet. I never let my puppies chase. My puppies are never allowed to chase. So there's nothing I ever have to go back and fix. They're always steady. And with that, though, they know, you know, they see these birds get up and sit right back down. So by the time they're 2 or 3 years old, they've seen it plenty of times that if a hen does it in the spring, you know, they're pretty well set. They're not gonna break. And
that's normal.
That's normal. It's no big deal with them. Exactly. So it's nothing I have to go back and fix and try to overcome. To where that dog is going to remember back from a couple years ago where he was allowed to break and chase and revert back to that. So it's, you know, but it's also a safety thing as far as guiding. I don't want my dogs running in, you know, if a bird flushes, I don't want them to chase. I want them to stand there because most of the clients I know pretty well, but you know, you get a few that you're not sure of and they're excited, birds flush and, you know, guns start going off. I don't want my dogs in front of the gun. That could be a bad situation.
Absolutely.
So that's why I just,
once I was hunting and my dog was pointing a grouse and we were near a forest road and a truck was coming down that road and my dog was, you know, he was fine. He wasn't going to break on the point, but that truck flushed the grouse, and the grouse went across the road, and so did my dog, and he got hit by that pickup truck.
Oh, no.
So he's fine. He was fine. Those guys piled out faster than I've ever seen anybody pile out of a pickup truck before. And that was the point when I said, that will never happen again, because I couldn't control that situation. You think that you have control and that it doesn't matter, but that was a huge wake up call for me. So that's, I started working on him being steady to wing at least at that point.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing with woodcock banding. You don't have to be steady to wing and shot. We're obviously not shooting. We call it steady to wing and torture.
It is kind of torture on the dog.
I bet.
They have to stand through all of it.
Seems like in podcasts all the time, we hear about Pine Ridge Grouse Camp. People bring it up and everything, but nobody ever talks about what it is. Can you guys just get into it? What is, I mean, it's this mythical place that's somewhere.
Describe this place.
Yeah.
It's more than just the location. It's the people.
Yeah,
sure.
It's a state of mind almost. So it's a lodge that's in north central Minnesota and owned by Jerry Havel and his wife Brenda, and he's got other family members that work there. And when did he start it? Do you remember?
About 12 years ago now. To go way back, the Pine Ridge is based on, it was the Havel family deer camp. Jerry's dad and uncle bought it in the early 80s, I believe, at the deer camp. They're, you know, just their deer stand still sitting up there, and I don't know if they still mm-hmm. deer hunt it. But as it went on, people would go, "Hey, Jerry, can we come stay at your cabin and go grouse hunting?" You know, well, sure. Yeah, Jerry grew up grouse hunting. He was a big grouse hunter, so that was no problem. Jerry's like, "Come on, we don't need many reasons to go grouse hunting." So Jerry would invite them up. They'd stay in the cabin, and it gradually turned to where more and more people were coming. And Jerry had a little, a little bit of a health scare years ago. So he decided, I'm going to give this a full go. And they talked about it. And he and Brenda said, let's do it. Let's make it. So Jerry said, we're going to turn this thing into a grouse camp. And Earl Johnson, who just passed away not long ago, Earl was one of the founding guides, I guess, and some of the other guides. But they added on the lodge and a few little cabinets, little miniature cabins with four beds and a couple of them, things like that. Built a big kennel. The main lodge is still there. The original cabin's there, and it's on the lot they have. But it's either way you come into it, you're going, a couple miles down a dirt road, then half a mile down a long dirt driveway, and you get back in the woods, and it's mystical. And you're surrounded by people of like mind, bird dog people. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of which just care about the dogs, and yeah, we'll shoot a few birds and have a good time, but we're going to sit by the fire and tell the stories and things like that. Jerry and Brenda have done a great job.
And everybody comes together.
Yeah.
You never know if you're going to have the CEO of an international company sitting next to a lineman.
Right.
And
right.
Everybody comes together because we're all there for the bird dogs and hunting.
Yep. Yep. And there are some people that come every year and stay for a week, which, I mean, it's a pricey thing. And then there's some people that come, it's their once in a lifetime bucket trip, but they're sitting right beside somebody whose family built America, and they don't even realize it because you wouldn't realize it. You wouldn't realize who you're sitting beside because nobody talks about it. And everybody,
and it doesn't matter.
And it doesn't matter. Everybody's equal. And the guides, we sit at the table and eat dinner and breakfast with the clients. We tell the stories. And it's fun. And everybody's a family. You come in as a new guest and you leave as a family member. And that's how he wants it.
Absolutely.
And the family, like she said, the family, Brenda helps out. Jessica helps out. Parker comes in sometimes. The kids help. And now Milo, Jessica's son, Milo, the third generation's there, and mm-hmm. even Jessica's husband come, Matt will mow the grass or do whatever Jerry asks. So it's a family business and it's run like that. And that's where we chip in because we know it's a family business. You do what you have to do to make sure it runs. And that's what we do. But with that being said, when you can surround yourself with that many people and you sit by the fire at night and a woodcock flies over your head, then another one, then two or three more, because they're going out in the feed right at dusk, and you're sitting there with a, you know, a nice cocktail in your hand. It's hard to beat. It's just a mystical, magical place. And it's hard to beat. I don't drive 1300 miles for nothing.
Speaking from the female perspective, you know, I've been a hunter for 35 years, and it was a lot different, you know, back when I started, and it's so inclusive now mm-hmm. in most places. And I have to say that Pine Ridge is exceptional when it comes to, you know, just being inclusive with everybody.
Yeah.
You know, there's female guides. Yeah, it's really great. We're all in it together.
Yep.
That's awesome. It sounds magical. You know, and so just to your point, just to add on to that, I had never been grouse hunting until last fall. I went to northern Wisconsin to the Rough Grouse Society grouse camp, and my mentor was a lady named Rose Danaher she's from Iowa. And it, you know, it was really cool to, you know, to have a younger woman to, like, hey, you know what, old man, I'm going to show you how to hunt grouse. And she did a great job. It was so awesome. She became, I think, a pretty good friend. You know, we keep in touch. She's been on the podcast. So,
yeah, I don't have any problem taking people out. And I'm also a forager. So Jerry tends to send people out with me that they enjoy more than just the hunting. You know, I've had, it's like, oh, bogey just went on point. Oh, there's some mushrooms. He'll hold.
Yeah, we've got time.
He'll stand there. He'll stand there.
And then go over and shoot the bird.
And Jerry is very good at that. He's very good at knowing who he can put with whom and how that will work mm-hmm. out. But he's also very good at bringing new people into the fold to make sure they will fit in, because even if somebody didn't come with your party or your group, that person can still ruin everybody else's trip if he just doesn't fit in right. And Jerry was a salesman. He was a big outdoor salesman, sold lots of big firearms and things like that, managed a lot of money. So as a salesman, he can read people very, very well. One of the best I've ever met. So he can read people on the phone. And he knows that person is not going to. Yeah, he really is. Yeah, exactly. But he knows that person's not going to fit in at camp. And if, you know, and like I said, you know, some person, you might have come up with a couple of your best friends. You're having, you three are doing great, but there's this guy that came with these other people that is just ruining everybody's vacation. And it is your vacation. And Jerry's good mm-hmm. at knowing that before they get there and taking care of it. You know, and he might just have to say, sorry, we're full that week. But he knows how to handle it. He knows how to manage it. But he's also knowing that he's making your vacation better by not letting somebody like that in. So, and that is that is tricky. That's very tricky. But it also ensures that everybody has a great time.
He does it exceptionally well.
And we eat pretty well, too. So that's, you know, no matter what kind of day
it's been. Yes, we do.
No matter what kind of day it's been, if you get back and you have a great supper and, you know, and have a lot of fun around the fire or share some conversation and a great meal, it always ends the day perfectly.
Shout out to Chef Rachel.
I'm telling you. Yeah, she's gonna be abandoned camp, so.
Is she really? Oh my gosh, I did not know that. That's
awesome. I gotta bring some venison up, so clear out the freezer.
She fits in with us. She's sassy and quirky and
works hard.
She likes the outdoors and hunting. Yep. And she works really hard.
Yeah.
She fits in super well with us.
Yeah, she does.
One thing that I've learned as I get older, I used to hunt because I like to eat things that fly and walk around out in the woods or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I got into dogs, and I really loved watching the dogs work. And to me, that was the prize in the hunt. But I think the older I get, the social experience of the hunt is a lot more important to me. And I'll still go out by myself or just me and my dog. I'll get in the tree stand and hunt deer every now and again, although it's not really my favorite thing to do anymore. But it's before the hunt, it's after the hunt, or if I'm hunting in a place where we can actually talk for a little bit while we're hunting, that's going to be the most enjoyable hunt, whether we limit out or we don't even point a single bird. I'm still going to have more fun on that one.
Yep, no doubt. Well, yep, exactly. You know, it was originally, it was one of the original social gatherings for early humans was the hunt. They came together to harvest things. They knew it worked better as a team. So that was a social gathering. And that still courses through us.
That's why people like us like to hang out together, I suppose.
I yes, sir. Exactly right.
That's right.
Well, speaking of hanging out, I've kept you guys hanging out on this call for a while now, a lot longer than you guys committed to. And I really appreciate that.
Oh, it's no problem.
This is fun.
It is. I really enjoy doing this. Steven, can you give us a couple closing thoughts, please? And then we'll go over to Debbie. So Debbie gets to really close it out.
A couple closing thoughts. You know, I would say put all the pressure you can on your dogs to learn quickly. Start them off early. Let them make their mistakes and learn. You know, nobody learned to walk without falling down. So don't be upset when your young dog makes a mistake, as long as you correct that mistake and let them learn from it. Every good grouse dog out there learned by bumping grouse. I don't care what the breed is. They're going to bump grouse until they figure out they got to point it from 20 yards. It's not a pin raised quail. It's not a pigeon in a trap. It's out there trying to survive. So let your young dogs make the mistakes to learn from them. And do your best to get somebody to come out and do your shooting if that's necessary, so that you can handle your dog and take turns doing that for each other. And I promise you, in the long run, you will have a much better dog.
And what makes a wild bird dog?
Wild birds.
Wild birds. Yep. So find yourself a breed that fits with you, and find yourself a good breeder, especially one that, you know, is willing to help you. Steven has been really great in answering questions and, you know, helping me as I kind of go through this whole process. So, you know, finding a good mentor, if you want to get into hunting, that you need to find yourself a mentor and somebody that can help you.
All right, guys, thanks so much for being on the show. I really appreciate your time.
No problem. Thanks for having us. No problem. Thank you.
And like a horrible host, I forgot to ask Debbie and Steven for their contact information. And thanks to technology, I was able to do that afterwards. You can contact Debbie by email at darkwoodgordonsetters@gmail.com. Or you can contact Steven through his website, stonybrookgordonsetters.com. I hope you enjoyed episode number 10 of The Woe Post. You can contact me on Facebook or Instagram at The Woe Post, by email, bill@thewoepost.com, or through my website, www.thewoepost.com. To support the podcast, you can become a patron at patreon.com/thewoepost, leave a 5-star review on Apple, or share it with a friend. Stay steady, and God bless.